The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Ingrid Patel Lee. Ingrid is a designer and the founder of the blog The Aesthetics of Joy. She has been featured as an expert on design and joy by outlets such as the New York Times, Wired, PRI's Studio 360, CBC's Spark, and Fast Company. Her 2018 TED Talk received a standing ovation and has been viewed by nearly 2 million people. She was formerly design director at IDEO and was a founding faculty member in the Products of Design program at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. She has a new book. It's called Joyful, The Surprising Power of Ordinary Things to Create Extraordinary Happiness. Ingrid, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In the introduction of your book, you write that, quote, joy isn't hard to find at all. It's all around us. And I think many people feel that joy really comes from within, but you're talking about joy that doesn't start from within.
It's true. I think that's certainly the impression I had, you know, when I was growing up, and was that joy was something that we find within, or it's this very ephemeral feeling. And the idea that it can come from our surroundings, I think, is a little bit of a foreign notion. And so it was to me, but that changed in a sort of an instant when I was in design school. Mm-hmm. It sort of caught me off guard. I was in a design review and a professor said, your work gives me a feeling of joy. And that really was because of, you know, all of what I had just said, you know, wasn't something I was expecting. And so that really led to me starting to wonder about the ways that our surroundings actually can create joy.
Yeah, and I was curious, like, your journey in terms of seeking out the evidence, the academic research, the underpinnings of these ideas. Is that a journey you've been on for a long while, or is that something that's more recent?
It's been 10 years now. So yeah, it's been a long journey. And part of the reason it was such a long journey is because the research in this area is really emerging. I mean, I think it's fair to say that psychology as a discipline has been a very inward-looking discipline.
Yep.
And so when I first set out to try to understand what was the connection between our surroundings and our emotions, I found a lot of research from the world of psychology that was about our attitudes, our behaviors, our neurochemistry, but there wasn't a ton of stuff about our surroundings. And that has grown, I would say, exponentially over the last 10 years.
Yeah. So we're in very similar situations in that I've spent 30 years at Second City in an improvisational comedy theater. And what I know about IDEO, because I've worked with them a fair bit, you know, we both are in very empathetic creative fields. And I think that makes it sort of a natural transition to go, okay, so what's underneath this stuff? And there is literature there, but it is emerging. And every year there's something kind of new in say studies of awe, and I think it's especially powerful for those of us who have applied it in a business context to see how it works outside the ivory tower. But we have to kind of go back to the ivory tower to make sure we got it right, because I don't know about you, but I had a lot of assumptions about why our work meant certain things or how it worked. And it kind of proved me wrong a lot, because, I mean, our perception of things is faulty. And I'm curious how much you were challenged along the way.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think for me, it was in a way a double whammy, because You know, just as research on our sort of our connection to the physical world has sort of been ignored or overlooked, I think also research on emotion has historically been kind of overlooked, and that is sort of catching up as well. And so it's sort of these two spaces that intersect. So how our surroundings affect our emotions? They're like the two stepchildren of the psychology world, and so they are just catching up. But in terms of how I've been challenged, you know, I don't know that I had a lot of ingoing assumptions. I really was coming to this pretty fresh. I was working, you know, I was studying design when I first started doing this, and I was so new to that field because I had come from the world of branding and strategy, and so and market research. I was really focused on studying people, and so working with design, everything was new. You know, I was new to working with my hands. I was new to the study of color, to the study of line and form. And so I actually didn't have a lot of preconceived notions about it. And my process really was to start with people and start talking to them about the things that brought them joy. And then from that, starting to see patterns, starting to notice patterns and noticing that actually, there were certain things that seemed to cut across cultures, certain things that people just said over and over and over again. And there are things like, you know, cherry blossoms or bubbles, balloons, tree houses. And so for me, this really became a journey of, it started with, you know, how do our surroundings create joy? But once I started to hear about these things from people, then it became a question of trying to understand, well, why? Why do these specific things create a feeling of joy?
Yeah. And so the chapter on color grabs us right away. And that's one of the first chapters. And the story that kicks off your book is about the capital city of Albania, which is a place called Tirana. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Tirana, yes.
And that was not a good place to live in the 1990s, right? It was kind of a rough city.
Right. Well, so what happened is after the fall of communism in 1990, Tirana went through a period of decline. And part of the reason to hear Edi Rama, who was elected mayor in 2000, tell it, part of the reason is that, you know, when you've been living in a society where the collective has been emphasized for a really long time and individualism has been suppressed, people sort of went wild with individualism. And so people started, you know, putting all sorts of weird add-ons to their buildings. They started building private enterprises in the middle of the city parks, so there were no city parks anymore. Organized crime and corruption were rampant through the city, and eventually, and people weren't paying their taxes. So, so the treasury sort of became bankrupt over time. And what happened in 2000 was that this new mayor was elected, and he was a painter. That was his background. And so, you know, faced with almost no money in the treasury, he decided to do something a little bit desperate. He started painting big murals on the downtown buildings, just covering them. In fact, they weren't even just murals. They were actually, he covered all sides of these buildings in vibrant patches of color. And almost immediately, people stopped littering in the streets. The shopkeepers started removing the metal grates from their windows, and people said that the streets felt safer, even though there were no more police on the streets. And then people actually started to pay their taxes. And so 5 years after this painting project began, so it was a 10-year decline, and then 5 years after this began, what they found was that the number of businesses in Tirana had tripled, and the tax revenue had increased by a factor of six. So it had gone, you know, it was fascinating to see how something as simple as color, and I think that we think of as superficial, could have such a deep effect on a community.
Yeah, you actually write, quote, it is nearly impossible to separate color and feeling. And I think when you say that, we get it, right? But you don't think it. It's not something we're walking around with. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting in this chapter is you kind of uncover, could it be called a color bias in Western society? And I don't mean that in terms of race. It's that this bias against colorful things.
Yes. So this, I think a lot of people feel it intuitively, that, you know, as we get older, we feel like we have to dress for our age, right?
Yeah.
And over time, that means we really stop wearing color, or we stop wearing bright colors, and we wear a lot of black and gray, and that's what looks, you know, adult. But if you go back to 1810, Goethe, in his theory of colors, said, savage nations, uneducated people, and children typically prefer vivid colors, whereas people of refinement avoid them in their dress. And so what he was saying, he's sort of creating this equation that to be adult, to be mature, to be sophisticated, and really to not be primitive, which I think is, you know, during that period, to be seen as civilized and not primitive was a priority for Europeans of that time. He was saying that we had to avoid color. And that really carried forward into the modernist movement, which also preferred sort of subdued colors. And so I think over time we have a kind of cultural chromophobia in the West that you don't see in a lot of other cultures.
Yeah, that's so interesting and so true. Your chapter two is about abundance, and I don't know how much you know about improvisation, but the entire concept of yes and is a practice by which groups of people can generate an abundant amount of ideas. And one of the key elements of this idea is letting the strange, weird, and perverse ideas live alongside the more traditional ideas. And I thought it was really interesting when you pointed out that the places where of abundance that we can point to are things like carnivals and circuses and flea markets, or like even like Wes Anderson films, are these, they're the sort of strange outliers. And we ask the question, or you ask the question of like, why are we not injecting our regular world and our day-to-day living with these kinds of abundant ideas?
Right. And I love the idea of tying abundant. I mean, what you're talking about is, to some extent, the idea that creativity is a practice of abundance.
Yes.
And it's a practice of leaning into abundance, of quantity over quality, mm-hmm. because the quality will be in there if you get the quantity. That's certainly an IDEO idea as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we, you know, we have become accustomed to the notion of minimalism. And I say minimalism not as a lifestyle, of course, you know, no issue here with sort of paring back extra stuff and decluttering and eliminating the unnecessary. So that's not what I mean. I mean an aesthetic of minimalism where we're talking about Spartan surfaces, very sort of minimalist boxes, and that sort of architectural philosophy that dominated modernism. And I think we've come to see that as sophisticated and avant-garde, and I think it deprives us of a lot of the natural joy that we find in sensations and in the sort of rich palette of sensations that certainly our ancestors would have found in the natural environment.
I think it's likely, in your experience of working with IDEO, because we're very similar in terms of our craft and how we get there. Because in what I learned over time at Second City is, like, I love the improv process. It's messy. You go down these weird, you know, tangents, which make you have these great discoveries that end up having nothing to do with the end product, and that's okay. You still get to an end product. We know we have to finish this show, but then we also know we're going to go back into rehearsal and play again. And I think I think we live in a time in our culture where people think that's an either or, and it's not. It doesn't. It never is in terms of getting to the kind of quality work. I just talked to recently on the podcast one of the guys at Apple who helped design the iPad and the iPhone, and you know they went down this weird journey and they threw stuff out and they came with a bunch of ideas to get to this beautiful thing. So it's sort of the when you have a taste of the process, it's really hard to just be all product all the time.
Right. And I think that it's important to keep in mind that all abundance is not waste, right? Yeah. There are some things that are wasteful, but the kind of abundance that I'm focused on in the book is this idea of sensorial abundance over material abundance.
Right.
And that's something that we can create without necessarily a lot of waste. So for an example I love is polka dots or stripes, for example. These are patterns, these are surface treatments that feel abundant to us because of the repetition of elements. And many patterns do this for us. They create a feeling of abundance. But there isn't they create a sensorial feeling of abundance, but there's no material waste. So I think that, we've been maybe conditioned a little bit to fear abundance because it feels wasteful, and recognizing that both in the creative process and in our surroundings, we can create abundance without necessarily it being wasteful.
Yeah. There's a great story that you talk about in this chapter. You write about an artist and poet couple, Shusaku Arakawa and Madeline Ginz, if
yes.
I'm saying it close.
They built
a rather unusual apartment building outside of Tokyo that you got to stay a night in.
Yes, this is called the Reversible Destiny Lofts. And basically what they believed is that walking around in spaces that don't stimulate our senses, the kinds of sort of everyday environments that we spend our time in, they believed that that contributes to aging. Because they felt that, first of all, that we have not just five senses, that we have thousands of senses. And while that sounds hyperbolic, in fact, researchers believe that we have somewhere between 15 and 21 senses. But our senses are kind of like convenient groupings of things. But for example, our sense of touch is not just, one sense. We have four separate receptors in our skin. So, for example, we have receptors for temperature, for pressure, for pain, and for itch. Those are all different senses, but we sort of lump them together. So, so they believed we had, thousands of senses. And so they felt that, just like a muscle, if a muscle starts to atrophy, if you don't use it, our sort of perceptual system and our brains are the same way. And that by having understimulating environments that we age more quickly. And so they created this apartment building to do the opposite. And so you walk in and it really looks like, it almost looks like a child's drawing come to life. And when you walk in, it's sort of all these spheres and cubes that are sort of set on top of each other. The floors aren't level. They actually slope. And so they're, instead of traditional furniture, they're poles that you hold on to. And there are hooks in the ceiling that you can hang things like hammocks from or any other kind of hanging furniture. Or storage that you might want. And there are dozens of colors in every direction. And it's wild. I mean, it's a little much. But what I have found interesting after coming back from there is that there's research now in animals, and this is a burgeoning field of research on what they call enriched environments. Mm-hmm. So it's almost exactly their theory, right? Arakawa and Ginz theory. And the research on enriched environments suggests that not only is cognitive development enhanced when animals spend time in enriched environments, sensorially enriched environments, but also cognitive decline is reduced. And they've tested, parallel conditions to things like Alzheimer's in animals, and that these environments actually slow cognitive decline. So while we don't necessarily need to live in exactly the reversible destiny apartments, I think that there's something to the idea that having, abundance and sensation in our environments can be good for our brains.
Yeah, reading this, I was like, oh, I don't know. But then I sort of flashed on the fact that I talk a lot about in our work how we need to get people comfortable with discomfort, divergent thinking, cognitive dissonance. All of that sort of feeds innovation. And then really all this is saying is that that matters for the physical body as well. And of course it does, because we know this about like working out. It's like working out isn't working unless it hurts. That is just a fact. And that's how you know it's working. So there is, I mean, again, it's extreme, of course, to think, because I was wondering how you actually slept. I don't think that's in the book. Is there a bed?
Oh, yeah, I didn't talk about that. Oh, well, there's a sort of a futon-style mat. Of course, it's Japan, so you sleep on the floor. And there is one room that has a flat floor. That
right.
is a concession to the fact that people need to sleep. So they were not entirely impractical.
Yes, right, in this
torture
room.
In their design.
The other thing that was interesting about that got me thinking is you write in that chapter, quote, "Our brain can't develop in isolation. It requires a constant dialogue with the environment." And that's another thing, right? We always think in terms of it's this or that, and like it's never that. Like we know this in comedy, if the audience isn't laughing, I don't think you can call it comedy. Which means our art form requires participation. But of course, that appears to be a metaphor for everything. And so I think in your view of abundance, it's really sort of getting back to a healthy recognition of human beings as social animals who need each other and need the world they live in to grow and develop who they are.
100%. And I think, you know, what that quote that you mentioned is specifically referring to is the fact that, you know, when animals are raised with, for example, they're raised in the darkness, they're raised with no visual stimulation, mm-hmm. that part of the brain doesn't develop properly.
Right.
Or when they're raised with, you know, no sound, the auditory part of their cortex doesn't develop properly. So the brain is in a constant dialogue during its development with the environment, and that is used to calibrate. Those sensations are used to calibrate development. And so I think similarly, you know, it's that input from our environment, I think, is part of what keeps us healthy. And I think if you think about when you go into nature, there's always a certain level of sensation. I mean, I remember, you know, I live in the city, the city's loud, but I remember taking a trip a couple of years ago out to going upstate New York for the weekend to a cabin. And I remember going outside and thinking, God, it's loud here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really loud. I mean, there's the noises of birds, the noises of insects, the wind and the trees. I mean, it's not loud in the noisy sense of the city, but it is, there's always something happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that recognizing that is helpful. To sort of calibrate what our senses are tuned for.
I'm glad you brought up nature because there's a quote in the Freedom chapter where you say, quote, "Nature views actually improve students' attention while also decreasing stress." So I called, my brother is an architect who builds schools. And I recalled him, like when I was a kid, he'd always give me like Buckminster Fuller books and Lewis Mumford books. And I'm like, didn't you talk to me something about the visual need of students? And he said, yeah, one of the things that he always does in classrooms is he wants to make sure that there is room for the students to view over 20 yards so that their eyesight doesn't get atrophied by just looking at a blackboard or a computer over and over. So this idea of a sort of a plane of visual sight is really important. And my kids go to a Rudolf Steiner Waldorf school, and they are all about the nature. I mean, you're when you have a little kid in there, they're like, you have to bring rain pants. You've got to have, because we're going out no matter what, unless it is lightning next to us, we're going outside. And so this idea of enjoying the chaos of nature is elemental to us.
Yes, it is. And I think this is an area where I would say even just in the last year, the research on this has exploded. And there's just so much support with increasing larger and larger populations to show that, for example, you know, moving to a greener area can lengthen our lifespan and reduce mortality risk. That having access to green space can decrease symptoms of depression in a sort of broad population, that just planting a few extra trees in a neighborhood can decrease violence in that neighborhood. So there's so many subtle unconscious effects of nature exposure, and they're far reaching.
Mm. So we grow up, we sometimes lose color from our life. We sometimes constrict ourselves. So we have a lack of abundance. The other thing that happens is we stop playing. And so I was glad that this chapter was a little later in the book because it's like so directly related to my work. And you write in the book, quote, play is one of our greatest means of accessing delight. So when you started looking into play, and I'm sure given your background, you're pro play anyway, but you did find a body of evidence that how vital play is to our health.
It's absolutely vital. I think play is interesting because it's one of the only human activities that we do solely for fun. Pretty much anything else that we do, there is a sort of secondary purpose to it, some other evolutionary purpose. And I think that's why play has been a bit of an evolutionary puzzle for scientists, because it's, they've sort of speculated that it has a role in practicing skills and development, and there is some, evidence for that, but it doesn't fully explain why we have play and why we continue to play into adulthood. But we do know that play, it lets us practice give and take. It increases our sense of empathy and fairness. It helps us solve difficult problems. And one of the theories is that play is a tool for resilience, that it actually helps us try out different solutions so that we can solve some of the biggest challenges that we face.
Do you know the origin story of Second City, where all the improv games came from?
No, I don't know this story.
So a woman named Viola Spolden was a social worker at Jane Addams Hull House in the 20s and 30s here in the south side of Chicago, and her job was to better assimilate the immigrant children coming into her care. So she invented all these improv games, many of which were in gibberish because the kids didn't always share language, and she had them play the games, and so they could communicate more effectively, empathize. And her son was a guy named Paul Sills, studying at the University of Chicago. He taught those games to his friends Mike Nichols, Elaine May. You get where this is going. That turns into the first improvisational theater in America, called the Compass Players in 1955, becomes the Second City in 1959. So, and then if you know what's going on in psychology and in the sort of intellectual realm of the 50s in the universities, especially at a place like University of Chicago and NYU, right? All these ideas are bubbling to the surface, and people like Paul Ekman are involved, and not even directly in this stuff, but it's so interesting to see this evolution of understanding what you're talking about, but no one named it until sort of really recently. They're starting to now tie it back and figure out what's been going on.
Right. I mean, when I talked to Stuart Brown, who's a psychiatrist who studies play, the way that he'll say it is that the science of play is where the science of sleep was like a generation ago.
Right.
And then now we really understand sleep. We understand how important it is. It's sort of common knowledge that sleep is vital. And he thinks that play is the same, that our understanding of it is a little bit behind.
Yeah. And I think it's funny, my friend Neil Stevenson, who ran the IDEO office here in Chicago, we were talking, because we do a lot of corporate work, of course, and he's like, don't call it play, call it improvisation. And he's right. Like, selling play in the corporate sphere really doesn't work right now. Selling comedy also is a rough thing, but people somehow, with the improvisation, they kind of get it. They're like, oh yeah, that's being agile and innovative. And it's like, man, like why can't you just become comfortable with that word? But in the same way that, like, who is going to let anyone say that, like, sleep is important, that you'd be laughed out of the room? And of course now it's like, this is the most important thing, is that you get at least 7 hours of sleep.
Right. I think that it goes back to the same bias that holds us back in color.
Yes, you're right.
I think that we have a cultural bias against joy because it seems immature. And so play, because it is an apparently purposeless activity, I think it's hard for people to understand the value in it sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think we often don't value the sort of non-linear. I mean, in a way, my whole body of work is trying to redeem some of these undervalued things. So we don't value color, that we don't value play, that we don't value magic, that we don't value nature, and recognizing that these things are not extraneous to our lives. They're actually essential.
Yeah, 100%. All right, we're coming close to asking you for a yes and story. But before we do that, I plucked this one quote out of the book. I just think this you're a lovely writer, which is kind of fun because not all of the you know, I read plenty of great books that the writing is sort of like, yeah, okay. And you're a really good writer. And this is an example of that.
Thank you.
Quote, "The unexpected welcome is a contradiction, a tension that pulls the mind in opposite directions between the strange and the familiar. Pure strangeness can be alienating on its own, but weird becomes wonderful when it is tethered to an element we recognize." I totally want to talk about this because recognition is such a key ingredient in comedy. And 100%, the only way it works is the weird stuff. The only way the weird stuff works is if someone can see just an inkling of themselves in the thing that's going on.
Yes, it makes so much sense that it underpins good humor.
Yep.
And it underpins, and I think it underpins also the kind of humor that is still funny over time.
Right.
And I think that's what makes things, you know, more than just a one-off punchline. Mm-hmm. But what makes something funny over time, and you keep coming back to it and you laugh every time you hear it, is that tension between the familiar and the strange.
Mm-hmm. My son is in comedy college right now. My wife runs the first ever BA in comedy writing and performance at Columbia College, and Second City is associated with it. Nick's a junior at Skidmore in upstate New York, but he's here for the semester. And they looked at stand up the other day, and they were seeing like Bob Newhart and even old stuff like Mom's Mabley. But he came back and he's like, "It's the first time I ever saw Richard Pryor." And I'm like, "What'd you think?" And he's like, "Amazing, brilliant." And I'm like, I love that
it's
still timeless. Holds up, right? And I was just like,
yeah,
oh, we
timeless.
Would go, I'm 52. I mean, we would go to the movie theater to see Richard Pryor movies. It's like, that doesn't happen very often with stand-up comics.
Right.
So I think that this idea of strangeness, again, tethered to recognition, is such a key component. Not just in comedy. I think this is the creative brain. You know, it's we just interviewed Dolly Chug, and that's going to come up next week. And she has this book on bias. And I was talking to her. I'm like, I don't understand why people have, you know, problems with gender pronouns and stuff like that. And she had a great analogy for it. She goes, "You should just think of it like tech. Once we have tech that's outmoded, we have no problem moving to the new tech. Why is that not the case for when we make these discoveries about human beings and about gender and about these other issues?" It's like, and I made the analogy. I'm like, oh, so bias should be like a floppy disk. You should be able to be, you know, move on, recognize that it was there. We recognize it, but something new and different is okay. Because it can advance us.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a tangent.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's what's the... I think maybe sometimes these things feel unfamiliar to some people. And what is the, you know, point of recognition to make it feel more... I don't know. I don't know if that's a way into approaching that.
Yeah, I wonder...
Each new innovation usually has something that's connected to the previous that helps us bridge it.
You're right, though. Maybe there's some nudge, some cue that we could provide. Because I had this conversation in the car with my son because, you know, he's a junior in college and they have no issue with the gender pronoun stuff. But I know a certain, you know, is it a lot of guys my age or older just can't. They just can't, and they get very upset by it. But to me, it's always like, isn't it polite to call people by the name they want to be called? Like if you're Mike and you keep calling someone Mikey and they don't like it, like you're being an asshole. So why is maybe we root it in more of like politeness and kindness? I don't know. I don't know what the nudge is.
Right. I don't know either, but it's a good question.
It is a good question. All right. So my final question for you is we ask every guest on the podcast for a yes and story. And the idea here in improvisation is you get nowhere saying no and you can't stop at yes. You have to say yes and. And I wonder if you've got a story from us from your work or your life.
The project that became my book, Joyful, began when I was in design school. And I worked on it for my master's thesis and I presented it. And the day that I presented it, I had sort of thought, oh, well, I'll spend the next few months working this up and trying to you know, turn this into a book, trying to begin working on this book. Mm-hmm. And I got the job offer from IDEO the same day.
Wow.
As I presented that work. And it was one of those things that in my heart, I thought, well, I really want to keep working on this project because I believe there's something here. I want to pull on this thread. And yet, IDEO is the job offer you never turn down.
Yeah.
At least it was for me. You know, it was sort of the dream job offer. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll try to do both. And it was a beautiful path, actually.
Yeah.
It took a lot longer to write my book than I expected. But in fact, I'm really glad for that because it created time for me to gather more stories, more examples.
Sure.
And way more research than I would have. And I was able to test the idea out a little bit more in practice by being in the practice of design with such, you know, amazing makers and thinkers at IDEO.
That's a great yes and story because the and is really the vital part of that. And that's what happened with you, right? You were able to have this really great career working at an amazing company that didn't end up stopping you from writing the book, but probably made you write a better book.
It definitely made me write a better book. And I can, you know, there's so many individual stories. I mean, not only are there ideas featured in the book, but there are also just so many individual stories or moments that were informed by things I learned there. And then there are things that I don't even know. I couldn't even tell you the provenance. I just know that 6 years there shaped me in such a way that this book came out, I think, much better than it would have had I just gone straight to work on it. And so I think sometimes the thing that looks like an interruption or a distraction is actually the real work.
Totally. The book is called Joyful, The Surprising Power of Ordinary Things to Create Extraordinary Happiness. Ingrid Fattel-Lee, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.